through the awakened brain, we can see, feel, and know that we're part of the symphony. That little squirrel on your banister is part of the very same symphony in which you are the violinist. And that guy on the bus who's irritating at first, well, that's the sign that it's time to cast off for the moment the narrow grip of control and hear what is life showing me now? Or I might say, what is the universe revealing to me now? What is God asking of me now? Whatever your words are, Hashem, Allah, spirit, force, the way you're being talked to. Are you going to listen? Because it'd be amazing to see what life is showing you now.
Welcome to The Courageous Life, a podcast founded on the idea that taking risks, overcoming fears, and moving beyond the limits of our comfort zones are prerequisites for living meaningful and fulfilling lives. I'm your host, Joshua Steinfeld, and it's my mission to explore insights, practical strategies, and inspiring stories of everyday heroes that will empower more people to grow courage and awaken greatness. What if there is a possibility of tapping into a heightened awareness of the world around you and your place in it? Of moving from an achievement orientation, where so often the questions that are asked center around, what do I want? And how can I get it? To a more expansive, open, and receptive way of relating to our experience as human beings. An awakened mode of awareness that might be thought of as engaging in a dialogue with your life, inviting questions like, what is life revealing to me right now? Then, listening deeply and learning to trust different ways of knowing that may be more intuitive or just hard to explain from a strictly logical point of view. Today's guest is Dr. Lisa Miller. She's a psychologist, a scientist, and a professor at Columbia University. And in her extraordinary book, The Awakened Brain, she explores these questions and ideas in depth, sharing her own deeply personal journey of awakening through her groundbreaking research and experiences professionally and personally. What Dr. Miller will reveal in this conversation, and more thoroughly if you pick up a copy of her book, is that humans are universally equipped with a capacity for spirituality. She calls it our birthright, and that she's found that our brains become more resilient and robust as a result. In addition to Lisa's wonderful storytelling, which you'll hear a lot of today, I was captivated by the cutting-edge science she outlined in the book, from MRI studies to genetic research, epidemiology, and more. As someone who tends to be a bit skeptical of things like intuition, mysticism, etc., it was both eye-opening and reassuring to dig into the surprising science of spirituality and Lisa's teachings about how to engage it practically in our day-to-day lives. Today, Lisa and I will have a deep and wide-ranging conversation about awakening. And full disclosure, this conversation may be the most personal I've had on the show yet. In the first half of the episode, Lisa will share some of her story of trying to have a child. She will openly and vulnerably describe many of the struggles and challenges her and her husband faced with infertility. And a most unexpected but beautiful turn of events that led to ultimately adopting their son. In listening to Lisa, I felt moved in the moment to share some of my own story for the first time on the podcast about being adopted, as well as some of the challenges that my wife and I faced over a number of years with having a child of our own. And somewhat similarly to Lisa, a very unexpected turn that our lives took during that journey. From a planned perspective, this interview went off the rails as we shared our stories back and forth for the first 25 minutes or so. And you'll hear us laugh about that later in the conversation. But as Lisa so aptly reminded me many times in many different ways, so often plans can go awry. And letting them do so by loosening the grip of trying to control things is actually a step toward awakening. In the latter part of the interview, we'll get things back on the rails to some degree as we explore a number of themes and profound insights from Lisa's work, including the two modes of awareness, achieving and awakened awareness, that Lisa has mapped in our brains through her fascinating work in neuroscience. She'll share how to tap into and strengthen awakened awareness. She'll describe the many ways of knowing, including logic, empiricism, mysticism, and intuition, and the validity of them all. We'll talk about how adversity, hitting rock bottom, or developmental depression can often be the catalyst for growth and transformation. Lisa will share more from her clinical experience and her research about the role of spirituality in medicine, clinical treatment, and healing. You'll also hear Lisa actually guide me through a meditation during our time together for tapping into awakened awareness that she's used with thousands of people around the world. And if you'd like to, you can participate yourself as you listen to the episode. Or if you'd prefer to do the practice later, I've made it really easy to come back to. You can find it in the podcast feed under Practicing Courage episode number 15, which is titled Being in Dialogue with Your Life. Lisa will also share a variety of inspiring and moving stories about healing, meeting life from a place of love, and recognizing the reality of everything and everyone being connected. This is one of the more profound conversations I've had on the podcast, and my hope is that you find it both inspiring and practical. Last but not least, in case you're not familiar with Lisa, here's a few highlights from her career. She's a New York Times bestselling author of The Spiritual Child and a professor in the clinical psychology program at Teachers College, Columbia University. She's also the founder and director of the Spirituality Mind-Body Institute, which is the first Ivy League graduate program and research institute in spirituality and psychology. And she's held over a decade of joint appointments in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University Medical School. Her innovative research has been published in more than 100 peer-reviewed articles in leading journals. And Lisa speaks and consults around the awakened brain and the spiritual child for the U.S. military, businesses, personal development and faith-based organizations, schools and universities, and for mental health and wellness initiatives. You can find more about Lisa, her books, and her work at lisamillerphd.com. All right, I think that's about enough of an intro from me. Without any further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Lisa Miller. Well, Lisa, welcome to the show.
I am completely excited to speak with you.
Well, the feeling is mutual. You know, you used in some of your there was so much beautiful language in your book, The Awakened Brain. And sometimes you would talk about these findings or insights as you progress through your journey in studying spirituality. And one of the words that I'll just pick out to describe one of those findings that really struck you is you said, this was breathtaking. You know, and as I was reading your book, I found that a really appropriate word for the way in which you wrote. There were just moments where I felt so deeply connected that sort of touched my heart in a way that not a lot of nonfiction books always do. And I read a number of them for the podcast in preparation for interviews. And I just wanted to really acknowledge your willingness to share so openly and beautifully and vulnerably your story and the incredible research
and pioneering work you've done. So it's a beautiful, beautiful book.
Joshua, thank you. Thank you. It was important to me when I wrote The Awakened Brain that I not only put out the science alone, as if to say the only way of knowing is empiricism and logic. It was important to me to emphasize through the narrative that we are knowers in many ways, that yes, we are magnificent empiricists and logicians, and equally, we are intuitives and mystics. We all have a skeptic. And when we can bring our natural organic forms of knowing, really our innate epistemologies, into confluence, we then have a dialogue in ways of knowing that leads to a much more vibrant and inspired life. So, you know, instead of say, you know, don't look at the man behind the curtain, here's the data, it's all out there, and it's up to you all to start doing the work, I decided to pull the curtain back and be the little man behind the curtain. say, you know, this is the journey through which I discovered multiple forms of knowing to be hard data, to yield hard data.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And I'd love to revisit those different ways of knowing later. So we'll come back to that. But before jumping too far ahead, I'd love to kind of ground us. I always begin with a little bit of invitation into your own story, and you can, you know, share whatever you'd like to hear. Since this is the courageous life, was there some sort of challenge or adversity that you faced? And this could be anywhere in your life. It could be early on, it could be starting your career, wherever it might be, that you feel sort of influenced your trajectory, largely of what you're doing professionally today. Does anything like that come to mind as a way in?
There were several inflection points in my path, stories along the way, which were formative, which were really hairpin turns in my own road of life. The story I emphasized in The Awakened Brain, I might want to share here, because it was the one that was most directly related to the body of science I bring forward, that depression and despair and existential pain is actually the knock at the door for a spiritual awakening, is actually the ignition for a deepening of our inner way of being. And so the story that I think, you know, is indispensable in my road of life to that realization was the struggle my husband and I faced for 5 years, 5 very long years, with infertility.
Yeah.
Shall I share?
Yeah, please. Okay. Absolutely. Thank you.
So we were, you know, got married young. My friends all sort of pulled me aside and said, you know, you're only 24, you just got engaged, you know, marriage is forever. And they called me child bride, and they no one really got it. But we wanted to get married, wanted to spend our lives together. And after about 4 or 5 years, we, you know, suddenly we're 30, and we decided it's time to start a family, which you can hear in the assumption was, let's flip the switch. We're ready now. You know, he'd gotten the career underway that he had wanted. He was a lawyer at a law firm in New York. I'd gotten my doctorate. I had a postdoc. It was time to start a family. So we started. We tried, as they say. We went off to St. Martin, came back, no baby. We said, well, you know, it's one for one. We went off to Sedona, came back, no baby. And I thought, well, you know, it's early. And after this went on with 6 months, 10 months, a year, I started to get this very haunting, creepy feeling. What if something's wrong? What if we can't conceive? And it had never dawned on me. I was, you know, now about 31. He was 32, healthy as could be. So I just, you know, checked things out. I went to an infertility doctor and he said, oh, they're healthy. He's healthy. You will get pregnant. We will get you pregnant. And you can hear the same supposition of radical control. Mm-hmm. It is time now, flip the switch. We will get you pregnant. That really in the air and water of our culture, I was never aware at that point, was this implicit idea that when something big is going to happen, we got to make it happen. This went on 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. We started ratcheting it up from IUIs to IVFs, 4 years. We were really getting very, very depressed. And every failed in vitro started to feel like a funeral, like that little tiny, tiny, tiny embryo had died. That little tiny union of the two of us, I could visualize it had fizzled out. And it was beyond painful. And we started to look hideous. Like I was so sad. My husband couldn't sleep. Our friends stopped inviting us to baby showers, thinking it would torture us. It was awful. And no one talked about it. No one talked about the struggle with conception in our culture. So this continued, and I thought, well, we've got to fix this. Again, same supposition. So I did what an empiricist and a logician does. I researched it, and I set before me an empirical competition between those doctors in the United States with the highest rates of conception. Classic. I set up a whole and there we went. We went from one around the corner to the one across town in New York to the one in another state to finally we found the team that had invented in vitro using sea urchins. And we thought, well, clearly they will get us pregnant. And when we got there, they graciously, with big heart, said, we will get you pregnant. Well, there we were. This was probably now our 10th, 11th in vitro. My husband and I at this, you know, really top stellar research team in infertility, post-procedure on bed rest. He was by my side in solidarity on bed rest. Mm-hmm. And there we sat. I had this haunting feeling, you know, I just knew in my gut, my intuition, that this was not going to work. But, you know, I'd gotten a big, warm, reassuring slap on the shoulder. Everything went well. Relying on bed rest, and my husband grabs the remote at this, you know, we'd splurged. It was one night, this overpriced hotel. Clicks the remote, and what comes on is one channel, only one channel. And we're like, overpriced hotel, one channel. And he's okay.
What's this about? Yeah.
Exactly. And there it was for 4 hours, an interminable documentary of a little boy. An orphan, this little boy, to this day, it breaks my heart, lived alone in a garbage dump. The camera documentary pans the garbage dump. And through the translator, the little boy says, I don't care that I live with the trash. I don't care that I can't go to school. But it hurts so much to not be loved that I sniff glue to make the pain go away. And there we were on the 11th in vitro because we needed the child that looked like him, that had my sense of humor. We were in shock with ourselves. Wait a minute. There's a child out there who needed a parent. That little boy in the garbage dump needed a parent. All he needed was love and commitment. And all we needed was the deep love of a child. And we've been miserable for years, and he's been miserable for years. This is radical solipsism. The baby needs to have our schnoz and our, you know, self-congratulatory IQ and our this and that, you know, and that's not actually the love of a parent. And synchronicities like this that sort of chipped away at the ego and illusions of radical control and illusions that were narrowly makers of our lot kept coming. And equally with these, I call them synchronicities, the meaningful events way too unprobabilistic to have happened by chance. Like an empiricist would say, no way. Those events kept happening, and at the same time, to be heating up, were events showing another way. Like right as we were being told, you've got to release your illusion, your tight-fisted illusion that you're driving the bus of your own life, there was equally synchronicities increasingly gaining in momentum that showed us that we actually are not alone. And that as we give up this narrow notion of control and having and getting, there's actually a lot of people who show up to help us along the way. People I've come to call trail angels. And these people who show up and help us can be people we've known for years who open up their heart and tell us something deeper we never knew. Or, you know, story from a grandparent or best friend. Or they can be people we've met for literally 30 seconds at the Starbucks or on a bus who tell us precisely what we need to hear. That suddenly I realized that, you know, we are not alone sort of, you know, chipping away, practicing our violin, practicing our trombone. We are not instrumentalists alone. We are part of a symphony. We are actually part of a symphony. There's a larger unit of reality in which we are all co-facilitators. So I'll give you an example. Failed in vitro, totally depressed. I get on the bus. And the bus is headed up Broadway from our home on the Upper West Side to Columbia. Completely depressed. And I think, you know what? Of all days today, I'm a pretty friendly Midwesterner by origin. I'm sitting today in the back. So I go way back there. Literally no one's on the bus. It's, you know, I'm going in late, past 10, closer to 11. And who gets on the bus? But a quite extraordinary, unusual looking gentleman. And I think, you know, not today, not today. And he starts walking towards me. I think not today. Walks through the middle of the bus to the back of the bus. He sits down one seat away from me. And I think, you know, I have to confess, I felt he was imposing on my space, which is the type of bump or perturbation with which synchronicities often start. They're inconveniences because they're upsetting the radical grip of the ego. He turns to me and says, "Lady, you know what? You look like that type of real nice lady." And I was not at my best. "You look at that really nice type of lady that would go all around the world adopting kids." I just got to say that. Next stop, he gets off. And I've never seen him again. Right as I was realizing that we don't flip a switch to get the things we thought a priori we wanted, we're not puppeteers, right? There were people showing up to show me, but we are not at this alone. We are actually buoyant and we are loved. We are held and we're guided. Loved and held, never alone and guided. That was what I found time after time. And I share in the Awakened Brain the richness and depth of this path over 5 years, but it included the awakening of multiple forms of knowing. That just as I'd been a career scientist and I love science and I love empiricism and I think it's so beautiful, jaw-droppingly awesome, there are also profound mystical experiences and intuitive direct hits that are profoundly guiding. So the second thing I started to realize was not only do we need to move from radical control to a dialogue with life, but that I had been raised with literally a baby spoon since kindergarten all the way through high school and college and my doctoral program into my postdoc with an assumption in academia and in sciences per se, that somehow if we can show where humans are misguided, the fundamental attribution error, things like that, somehow we're more rigorous, we're more skeptical, that to point to human misperception, misalignment with the nature of reality is somehow more rigorous than to identify ways in which our perceptions are aligned with reality, are confluent with the deeper structure of life, and which therefore have traction, the proof is in the pudding, and yield fruit. And so I decided I wanted to understand how we might understand our deeper seat of awareness, what I've come to call the awakened brain, our deeper seat of perception, and start to explore if maybe that was not some sort of spurious artifact or illusion of a misfiring brain, as again, had been in the assumptive space of much of my education. But what if this was a potential through which we could actually, just as we see, we're loved, held, and guided, never alone, show up in the world to be loving, holding, and guiding and never leave anyone alone? What if our deep-seated perception into the unitive reality, what if our capacity to perceive the symphony where, you know, I have the violin and the guy on the bus has the trombone, what if our capacity to perceive the unitive reality actually potentiates our capacity to live into a unitive reality, where just as life has been showing up for us all along, fellow living beings, the guy on the bus, nature, we could equally show up for life and be then in a relationship that was far more loving and caring and guiding. We would be loving, holding, and guiding in and through the deeper nature of life. That is my greatest hope, that through the awakened brain, we can see, feel, and know that we're part of the symphony. That little squirrel on your banister is part of the very same symphony in which you are the violinist. And that guy on the bus who's irritating at first, well, that's the sign that it's time to cast off for the moment the narrow grip of control and hear what is life showing me now? Or I might say, what is the universe revealing to me now? What is God asking of me now? Whatever your words are, Hashem, Allah, spirit, force, the way you're being talked to. Are you going to listen? Because it'd be amazing to see what life is showing you now.
It's so beautiful. I so appreciate you sharing that particular story. I feel like that was almost like a four-dimensional lead-in. Like you covered so much territory in there through the art of storytelling and sharing your humanity and all of it. It was beautiful. And there's things I want to pick out of there and kind of follow as different threads through our conversation. But the first thing is just to acknowledge a few maybe synchronicities. I don't know if they are. And I've never shared this on the podcast before. But I was adopted at birth. Yeah.
Miracle, so I was... miracle. Right child, right at that time. You're the spiritual child of your parents.
So I was adopted at birth. Thank you. And what a gift that was. I had the opportunity to meet my birth mother when I was about 25. And she was, you know, kind of living with the story that I was going to be really angry. And I've just always viewed it as probably the most selfless act of love that there is. Okay. From my perspective, to be able to give up your child who you're so deeply connected with for a better life, you know? So we had that conversation and I met my wife, and my wife has a heart condition she's had since she was about a month old. And so we met, and long story short, I always had this idea. There was always this kind of narrative in my mind that, wow, what sort of an act of grace that I was adopted at a really good experience. She had a heart condition and it looked like probably not going to be able to have children, and we would adopt. And then there was this thing that happened where I got this strong inclination that even though I thought I was always going to adopt a child, that everything in my body was telling me that there was maybe some other option that might work better for us. And the same was true for my wife. It was kind of this unexplainable energy that when we got to the point of making the choice of what path we're going to pursue, as we look at having our own challenges around this process and going through, you know, depression and the whole journey around it, that we ended up pursuing IVF and surrogacy and all of this and having our own daughter. And we had, you know, who's connected by blood and genetics and all of it. And it's just this beautiful thing. And she's like the joy of my life. Her middle name is Joy. And so anyway, it's just you sharing that story kind of opens up the door for a sense of common humanity, not just with myself, we're just here having this conversation, but you wrote about it in your book, and so many people having their own different journeys around childbirth and the challenges with it and all of it, right? So I really appreciate that. And the other thing I want to pull out is this point that you made about being in dialogue with life. And it was so interesting going into these adoption, where we went to an adoption workshop, and it's like, oh yeah, this is what we're doing. This is the plan. This is it. Like, we've known it. We've known it for so long. And then getting in there, and there was this sense in there for both of us leaving that there was another route that we really needed to pursue. Like just a really strong feeling that we were both having kind of independently, and then checked in and had this conversation afterward. And that was really interesting because it was so unexpected to me. And it was just so
deep. Yeah. You simply deep, knew. Direct yeah. knowledge.
And I've never felt so connected to someone in my life as I do my daughter in just a different way. And maybe that's because of the adoption. Maybe that's because of a variety of factors. But that inner knowing was there. And this idea that you talk about, and a past guest on the show, Parker Palmer, talks about, which is really letting your life speak and learning to listen. And what a beautiful, beautiful notion.
May I share a bit about adoption?
Of course, please, yeah.
Joshua, I'm uplifted. I'm touched very deeply in my heart that you shared your story, including your journey of being someone's deeply loved spiritual son. What I've seen without exception is that the right child comes in the right way at the right time. Time is an active variable. If we'd shown up a year earlier or a year later, we would have missed our spiritual child. If our son had come through my body, he would have been a different person. There is a sense in which he is our absolutely confluent, perfect spiritual child. So I think that the miracle through which every child is brought into a family is precisely the path through which it is necessary that they arrive. To your point that adoption is an act of great love. See, let's, you know, I feel like you've raised something so important. I have adult friends who've been fed a very toxic narrative from outdated ideas in mental health, which are, you know, what about the woman who gave me up? What about the woman who gave you up? To your point, she wanted you to be deeply loved, to be cared for. You know, she chose to carry you. Yes. Right. So when Isaiah was born, it's deeply moving. He's given me permission, although I don't think I've shared this before. He's given permission. The woman left two notes who carried him. And the first note said, deeply moving, I will be back in 6 months. She loved him. Right. And the second note says, I have tried to support you. I terminate my parental rights. Please know you are loved. So moving, so deeply moving. So, you know, I think that idea that you're given to your spiritual family and love is incredibly important. And the equal side of the equation is that you were sought. I mean, you know, I sat down with my friends, again, adult friends who are adopted, and they said, you know, what about the woman that gave me up? I said, what about the way your parents, you know, you weren't just, you know, conceived on some Saturday night. They worked really long and hard to find you.
Yeah.
It was a pilgrimage. It is a sacred journey. They looked hard. They worked hard. You were wanted, maybe even more.
Mm, that resonates. I mean, you probably know that resonates, but that resonates maybe more than you know. It's so true.
From day one with Isaiah, we told him how we understand the story of finding Isaiah. Yeah, he was a tiny baby. He came home from an orphanage north of St. Petersburg, Russia, at about 10 months. And even before he was familiar with English, we told him the story. You know, Isaiah, everyone prayed for you, grandpa and pop-up and grandma and mommy and daddy. And then, you know, little baby boy, we took a plane to a train, to an automobile. And there we ran up the hill and we tossed him in the air and we'd all shriek with joy. And we found Isaiah. It was the Isaiah story. And this was the perfect story for someone at one or two. And then around four, we said, Isaiah, the symbolic four-year-old, he loved the river. He loved to play in the river. He loved little frogs in the river. We lived out in the country. And we said, Isaiah, you came down the river to our home. You are our baby Moses. And he loved that story. He'd say, I am baby Moses. And we'd say, yes, you are baby Moses. And this went on until he was about eight. And finally, the moment came. I'm driving my SUV. He's in the back with his buddy, middle row. Here, Mama, Johnny says that you are not my mother. My name is not Miller, and I am not Jewish. I said, Isaiah. I took a big, big, big breath. Do you remember? And he whipped his head around to Johnny, and he said, I am baby Moses. And Johnny says, what? And he said, I'm baby Moses. And Johnny says, what? And then Isaiah said, never mind. Johnny just did not understand. Mm-hmm. And then, I think there's more. And the voice shifts and he's desperate. Mama, Johnny says, what about the woman who gave me up? And there I took a deep breath because I knew the toxic, misguided, outdated narrative. And he answered the question. He's like, oh, I know. God whispered in her ear and said that you were crying for me. I said, that's right, Isaiah. That's exactly right. So when we tell the child the truth, deep truth, known through our intuition and our mystical experience and our heart and our soul, and yes, empiricism and logic and the whole nine yards, they are equipped to answer the most painful, challenging questions with an answer that is true, that has to do with the unit of reality. That woman loved him and we loved him. Yes, we both loved him. And she was one symphony player and we were the fellow part of one opus. We are one family. Period. We meaning human beings and living beings.
And one thing that you said, actually, my mom, my adoptive mom, but my mom.
Your mom.
She always, she told me from the time I could earliest understand that I was adopted, what it meant, all of it. So I always had that knowledge. It wasn't a surprise by any means. And I found that in my own experience really helpful, kind of like you're describing. And I just always was in awe of my birth mom and the love that was there and the love of my mom and my dad and the work that they put in and the heartbreak and all of it, you know, and just gosh, what a gift in so many ways. And so thank you again.
You are their miracle. You are their miracle. You saved their lives and Isaiah saved our lives. And he knows that.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I just so appreciate it, obviously. And I think where I'd like to go now is actually maybe another small synchronicity. You start off the book or early in the book by talking about this experience in Unit 6, I believe is a psychiatric clinic. And you talk about Yom Kippur service. I was raised Jewish and I started actually reading your book on Yom Kippur. And I get to that part and I just felt, oh, that's interesting. Like, what are the chances that this story's in here? And this is the first time reading this book. And here we are. And I want to pull out a quote from what you shared, and then allow you to elaborate, go whatever direction you'd like to. You are conducting the service, and you can fill in the details here, and you write, something happened in the back kitchen that wasn't happening through primary medical interventions of medication and psychotherapy. And the healing that was occurring in the back kitchen was specific to each patient's greatest need. That really struck me. And then you say, as a clinician and a scientist, I wanted to know what had really happened on Yom Kippur. So could you share a little bit about that experience and then what you found as a scientist, as a clinician, in terms of what really happened?
Joshua, it was quite a meaningful Yom Kippur in my journey. I will say that I was a new intern. I'd just gotten my doctorate. I was on a city hospital, a floor in New York, that because it was typical of the time, I refer to as Unit 6, because it was in no way due to those people per se, that cast of characters, that things unfolded as they did. But it was normative for the time that mental health was delivered, minus what I've come to call the spiritual core, that there was just no talk, no engagement whatsoever of the deep seed of spiritual awareness in treatment. And this was treatment delivered during the most painful, brutal time in people's lives. This was an inpatient unit in which people came profoundly depressed or in the midst of a psychotic episode. So the first thing I noticed as a young intern was that people were not getting better. We could sort of, you know, ratchet down the symptoms for a few weeks. And then, Joshua, they were back within a month or two, readmitted. And in these days, pre-digital, we would just expand the folder and expand the folder. And there were folders 6 inches thick. There were people who'd been there 17, 25 times. And I thought, okay, these are very bright clinicians. These are good-hearted people. Our training models, the state of the field, is insufficient to address the deepest form of human despair and suffering. It's undeniable. So I started paying attention and listening to the patients. And I wanted to know what their experience was and what they thought was the way through, how they had found in their many admissions to be their staff and their path forward. So I started getting pulled aside by patients, and they'd say things like, Dr. Miller, could you come here? And come here would mean, you know, not your office. It would mean down the hall, you know, into literally once was a pots and pans closet in the back of the unit. A patient in a very painful moment who was about, after dozens of admissions, to be sent upstate, which was sort of, it wasn't a death sentence, but it was a terminal end of her freedom. I said, Dr. Miller, I'm going upstate tomorrow. And she pulled out a rosary, knowing I'm Jewish. And she said, will you pray with me? And I said, of course. I mean, there's one answer there. So she says, Dr. Miller, I'll start. And she starts and she prays the rosary. And I'm with her in full heart and full presence. And then she says, now, Dr. Miller, you pray your way. And I said, I'd be grateful to. And I prayed the way that my mother had taught me to pray. And we went back and forth there in the pantry. And then she said, now, let's say something to each other. And she said, dear God, when I go upstate, please bless Dr. Miller. I of course prayed for her out loud. Mm-hmm. So the next day I came back, right? I'd gone home, seen my husband, gone out to dinner on the west side. I come back the next morning, her bed's made, she's gone. There was one answer. And I thought, whatever terror, whatever despair, whatever fright or existential hollow or loneliness she felt, her presence, our shared presence, as held by who I call God, spirit, the truth, my word is God, hers was God, was the only life raft for her. So can you possibly have a mental health system that prohibits that discussion? Or is that iatrogenic harm, where you make people worse by disintegrating the deepest seed of being, which is our awakened awareness, our capacity to be in a deep relationship with the sacred force, with the unit of reality? So that was an example that said to me, we've got to support these patients when they want it spiritually. So sure enough, Yom Kippur rolls around. We're sitting, all of us, the therapists, the interns, the patients, in one big, huge, it wasn't quite a circle. It was more like an oval in a long community hall. And the vibe was, I would not say that it was particularly nourishing or renewing. It was really kind of tense. The patients were anxious. Everyone's kind of staring each other down. And one gentleman shoots up his hand in the community meeting and he says, it's Yom Kippur next week. Where will we be going for the Yom Kippur services? And the unit chief sort of looks to the assistant chief and they down and they look up and they say, we're sorry, there's nothing planned for Yom Kippur. The clergy will be going home. And the patient who was bipolar started to get very agitated. He said, what? Nothing for Yom Kippur? Nothing for Yom? And he became very frustrated and very chaotic and explosive, got up and walked out. I looked across the room and there was another Jewish patient, a woman with severe recurrent depression, who had retreated to the point where her shoulders were forward. She was hunched. You could only see her forehead. Her despair had drawn her inward. And I thought, we can't leave people without Yom Kippur. We cannot leave the patients without a Yom Kippur service. So I approached at the end of the community meeting, I approached the unit chief and I said, listen, I'm not a rabbi, but I've been to 20 plus years of Yom Kippur services. I have my grandma's prayer book. Would you allow me to come in on Yom Kippur and facilitate a service? Yeah. And the unit chief said, sure, if you want. So I show up. It's Yom Kippur. Many of the doctors are gone. Many of the clergy are gone. And the patients who have arrived for our service have arrived with a very wonderful sense of anticipation. Their eyes were sparkly. And because there was no synagogue built into the city hospital, the place for our Yom Kippur service, our designated sanctuary, was a fluorescent lit kitchen with a linoleum table and bright blue chairs. Jewish patients who'd come for Yom Kippur sat around the linoleum table with a great sense of sacredness and specialness. They knew what it meant that today was Yom Kippur. And by each of the patients was their aide. None of the aides were Jewish and yet seemed to me to be religious people who treated this moment with great sanctity, understood the significance. And as we started together to share the prayers, these were prayers that every Jewish person in the room had said their whole life, at least once a year, over and over and over again. The prayers lifted us up. They took on a presence, a spirit of their own. And the bipolar gentleman was the one holding the cadence. It was his davening, him in the motion of his body, who really bound the group together and carried us forward. If there were anyone who approximated the rabbi, it was the gentleman with bipolar. He was leading the service in the depth of his connection. He was the furthest thing from chaotic or explosive. He was made whole in his connection in and through the sacred prayers. We went around the table. We shared what Yom Kippur meant to us. And I came to the woman who had severe depression. And as hunched as she had been in the community meeting, here she sat up tall and straight. She rolled her shoulders back. And she said, you know what? I always knew on Yom Kippur, we could ask to be forgiven because I have a lot of guilt and I have a lot of shame. But sitting here with you all and saying these prayers, I realize we actually can be forgiven. The deep reawakening, the reshuffling of meaning. That same woman came up to me 24 hours later, knocked on my office door and said, Dr. Miller, and I opened up, yes, I just want to thank you again for the service and remind you, you can be forgiven. I said, thank you. So her despair and shame and unworthiness was more than reversed. It was as if the sun were shining through her. And whatever the limitations of the ego, of the habitual understanding of who we are to one another, our go-to set, were far outshined by the presence of the numinous, the sacred, and the unit of shared spiritual community. What was the half-life of this? I'd say it lasted, the half-life was about 2.5 days. Once is not enough. It is a sustained way of being, to be in relationship to who I call God or source, and to show up for one another in that presence. What I've come to see 25 years of science later is that we are actually hardwired to be in a sustained relationship. A relational transcendent awareness is our birthright. And the same neurodocking station, the same circuits through which we are in relationship to source our higher power, God, is the same neurodocking station through which we feel that ultimate presence in our love for one another. Both are forms of relational spirituality. And that deep seat of awareness had been reignited in our Yom Kippur service. Thank you.
You know, this is just coming to mind. One of the past guests on the show is Frank Ostasevsky, and he founded the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. And he has sat with thousands of people as they've gone through the process of dying. And you may know Frank, I don't know. And he said something that really struck me, which actually relates to something you said in the book, and I think is kind of related to what you're talking about now. He said, you know, what I think life is really all about is not finding the house on the pretty street and getting a good job and getting a good relationship. He's like, those are good things. Like they're not bad, of course. What I think life is really all about has to do with these two big questions that the people I've been with in and around their dying have at the end of life. Am I loved? Mm. And did I love well? Mm. And then he said, if those are the two big questions at the end of life, why can't they be the two big questions right now? And then he went on to share that he wants to love life as much as possible. And you talked about something similar, which is this, you know, and this showed up in the kind of radical control that you talked mm-hmm. about when you shared your story earlier, or this time in your life that you share in the book where you're kind of in pursuit of chasing those sensible goals, the goals of advancement, of protection, of safety, you know, these sorts of things. Sure, they're sensible. And yet there's this kind of lack of fulfillment, you know, that comes from maybe a deeper meaning or purpose, or when we love life as much as possible, right? In Frank's words, I think if we're just following those sensible goals, you describe this as living as like half awake, right? Maybe only using half of our brains. I say all that and to bring it back around to this, which is in those moments where you saw these patients really come alive, patient with bipolar disorder leading this service, when nothing else really seemed to be working in this way. First of all, how do you think about what spirituality is? Like, what is it? And what is it about that quality that is so healing? And maybe you could share too some of the hard data about like it being protective factor against depression, et cetera.
Beautiful, Joshua. Wow. So first, I guess, to pick up on the questions of life, my questions are less sort of summative as I die. What will I ask? What did I have? And more of an operating manual. What is my stance in living? And I found the operating manual that I was given by well-intentioned people, K-12, college, university, air and water, our culture. What do I want? And how am I going to get it? And that includes, you know, what do I want to be? How might I improve myself? You know, what do I want and how am I going to get it? To shift that to actually, how might I be present to the deepest love in and through life so as to further that love? And what is life showing me now to realize that love? And the dialogue is in what is life showing me now? And the presence of being through which to discern the direction is to awaken by being present to the ultimate love. So what is life showing me now? And how might I be aligned with the deepest love, whose I call God's, but in and through all life, so that I might be continuous of that love. So that prepares my seat of being to be in the stance of unit of love. And then my attention to awaken to the direction that's written into life. We still have to say yes to it. You know, it's not for like the, you know, greatest meditators or most pious. It's everybody. We are all built with a natural capacity to be an awakened relationship to the unit of love that is in us, through us, and around us. We are built for it. To your point, what does science say? Science says that in every single human being on earth, there is an inborn capacity to be in relational transcendent awareness and to feel that presence in our love for one another. We are born with this neurodocking station. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to imply radical biological materialism. It is a correlate, body, mind, and soul. I would go more with monoist point of view, right? Mm-hmm. Body, mind, and soul, it all runs at once. So this is our birthright. If we look at twin studies, we can determine the extent to which any human capacity is innate or environmentally formed. So as your audience probably knows, temperament is half innate, half environmentally formed. More specifically, the variance, the differences among us are attributed half to heritability, half to environment. IQ is about 60% innate, 40% environmentally formed. The capacity through which we are in a deep dialogue with unitive, loving reality, relational, transcendent awareness is 1/3 innate, whether you look at Kendler's 97-99 paper, Bouchard in 99, a host of longitudinal twin studies since then, we are born with an innate seat of transcendent awareness, and it is a relationship.
When you say innate, are you saying this is seen like early in childhood or an early, like where, when you're describing innate, could you talk a little bit more about what that means?
So the twin study can determine that it is indeed in our birthright. It is our how we are built. But two-thirds environmentally formed means that how we engage into practices of transcendence or a language that pins down the transcendent awareness as real and valid, or a relationality that holds the transcendent presence, that is in the rich two-thirds embrace of our environment, our parents or grandparents, our community, our faith community, pastor, priest, imam, rabbi, outside of faith community, a community of service, habitat, for humanity, Doctors Without Borders, living in the Cathedral of Nature, living on Mount Rainier, where this is the two-thirds embrace. It is our birthright to have this, but we must cultivate it. And as we get older, it is a choice how we seek the two-thirds embrace. This is who we are. Does the child have it? Yes. There's marvelous data on children. Children might be less likely to pin the transcendent experience to language. They might not make the link, tether it to, you know, a lexicon or bring it up or not bring it up. But often a child spontaneously will say, I just feel that loving feeling, and they'll wave their hands, or they'll go up to a fellow living being and talk to a goose as if it were a fellow human being. The child knows that all living beings are conscious and relational.
I was really struck. This happened maybe 2 days ago. We've been having some people come over to the house, to arborist, to trim the trees. You know, they're overgrown and this sort of thing. And my daughter comes home, bring her home from school in the car. And I open the back, she's 2 and a half, open the back door, get her out of her car seat. And the trees, some of the branches that are like lying on the driveway, and they're going to be taken away. And normally she just goes into the house, the front door. But she stops and she looks over at the branches. And we've been talking about is the trees are getting a haircut or whatever. That's just how we've been talking about it. And she goes over to them and she gets really quiet. And then she touches the branches. And then she looks at me and she goes, this is sad. I don't like when the trees get a haircut. And she stands there and she's like touching and holding onto the branches. Not any sort of my influence. I mean, maybe there is in some degree, but like she just did this on her own. She says, Dada, this is sad.
Like, I call that unity of empathy, the deep pain of her heart to feel, you know, you're a wonderful dad to try to sort of lighten the blow and call it a haircut. We don't know, it could be like getting your arm cut off. It could be her fault.
That's true.
And her deep unit, but you are gracious and kind and gentle to try to, you know, soft landing. But her wisdom, right? Her deep unit of empathy. Yeah. You know, I'll share with you a story like that. When my center child was pretty young, about four, we'd prepared all day. We were going to go to the Special Olympics. I had a friend whose sister was in the Special Olympics, and we talked about it, and we talked about the Olympians, and she was so excited. And it was almost time when suddenly, clap of thunder, lightning, pouring rain, and the whole thing's rained out and canceled. And from the other end of the house, I hear this excruciating wail. Ah! And I run across the house. What is it? What is it, honey? They're going to be so disappointed. The Olympians, they've worked so hard, and she's weeping. And it's not because she doesn't get to go. She feels their disappointment. Now, here's another point where radical materialism in the air and water of academia has only looked at the side of reality where we are a point. It has not embraced the unit of reality where we are a wave. In truth, we are a point and we are a wave. So child development, being atomistic, has said, oh, the child over time develops so-called empathy because they have theory of mind. Now, that may be, but that is not a comprehensive theory. That may be true, but it is only a partial statement of empathy, because the child from the beginning does not need to wonder what the other person might be thinking as an atom over there, separate from the atom I am over here. The child also has the unit of awareness to feel directly the intense pain. And that is a gift with which we are given. We have been taught to shut that down. And that is actually one of our greatest strengths, to care and love and guide, to be loving, holding, and guiding for other people, fellow living beings. your daughter's right. Yeah. It is sad.
Yes.
Beautiful. Yeah. Absolutely. Saw her with open eyes and could, you know, it's hard to hear. Ouch, pang. And you were able to stay, which is what we need to do. Bear witness with love. Hear this.
Yeah. So picking back up. So one of the things that you describe about the awakened brain, please edit anything I'm going to say for accuracy and add anything, is there are these two modes of awareness. And we've kind of alluded to these with the conversation about Frank, Ostaseski, et cetera. Kind of this mode of awareness that's oriented around achieving the pursuit of sensible goals. And I think in your words, what do I want? How can I get it? And that can serve a really valuable purpose. It's practical, helps me stay motivated, driven, whatever it is. And then there's this other mode of awareness, awakened awareness. What you've been talking about for the extent of our time together, this openness, this being in dialogue with life, this being able to tune into the truth of our connected reality. And the list goes on, you know, my language, maybe not your language, but these two modes of awareness. And then you talked about how the awakened awareness kind of gets suppressed. And that's really my experience. When I was in school, I think you talk about the logician that's present, right? The skeptic that might be present. I think there's one other. These modes get really cultivated, or for me, I'll just say, they got really cultivated. And then these other modes of awareness, maybe the more intuitive mode of awareness, this awakened awareness kind of got suppressed or didn't get grown or strengthened. And I've sort of had to, through this podcast and through maybe my adult life, college and thereafter, sort of remember this awareness, this capacity, or re-tap into, because it's there, as you describe it. My experience is it is innate. And for me, I really like this word remembering, like coming back to, almost coming back to home, coming back to this innate capacity that's present. But could you talk a little bit about these two modes of awareness and maybe when they're in concert or harmony, what that can do in terms of our health, our well-being, other things that you might be seeing there?
And so you're absolutely right, Joshua. Most of our education system cultivates some forms of knowing, but leaves to atrophy other innate forms of knowing. We have organic epistemology, some of which lift weights and get strong, and some of which literally lie fallow. So indeed, empiricism and logic, very important, particularly for strategy and tactic and planning. If I think of my very first day in first grade, on my desk was one item, one thing. It was a planner. I was being taught how to think ahead, strategize. And it's been extremely helpful. It is an important skill. Mm-hmm. But tactics and strategy and research to close the deal is absolutely insufficient alone to lead a fulfilling, meaningful life. And in fact, I would say it is most brittle and insufficient in times of challenge or necessary change and transformation. So we absolutely do need tactics and strategy. We need our achieving awareness. A plus B plus C is 90%, 96% likely to close the deal. It is 90% predictive for an actuary or for administering medication. You know, it is helpful, tactics, strategy. And yet to find our deepest guidance, to find our guiding star, it is not done through tactics and strategy, because tactics and strategy wrap up all the information, harvest all the data from today, historically backwards. All we have when we plan and research and envision a tactical solution is historical data. It is in this instant useful, but incomplete. So I can use my historical data and I can figure out how to catch the A train and I can run and jump on that A train, have my ticket, the door closes. And when it pulls into the station, that A train, I have no idea where I am or why I want to go there, or did I want to go there? You know, it's like the talking heads. This is not my beautiful life. You know, where am I? Or to your colleague's point, this is not my beautiful house. How do we have lives that are deeply meaningful and purposeful? And by which I don't mean simply, am I going to be a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, or do I want to live on the East or West Coast? I mean ultimate purpose with respect to the deepest nature of reality. What is the nature of life, of existence? And what does that say about my walk in my time on earth? And this is incredibly important as we come of age. It's where Gen Z is right now. I need to find the meaning of life so I can go live one. But there's two other bridges. There's midlife How have I been living my life? What is my walk? Is it consistent with my talk and my vision? And then the third bridge as an elder, what is my spiritual footprint on this earth? And of course, in between, there's plenty of dances as well. So how do we reach into a meaningful direction? How do we pick what train we want to get on and where we want to go? And that calls for a deeper seat of knowing, a more profound look into the nature of life, who we are, the nature of reality. And we're built for that. It turns out we are inborn with the neuroperceptual seat to dial into the deeper layer of life and intuit, explore, have a sudden hit of the heart, a knowing, perhaps a mystical experience where in our mind's eye, we're shown direction. It could perhaps be simply a felt sense, but we are built to know in many forms. We are hardwired to know in many forms. Now, the skeptic is very important to help even deepen this connection. Wait, did I really feel that? Yes, I felt it. And when I listened to it, look what came around the corner. Or when I followed this deep intuition around the corner, look who I saw. So the skeptic is welcome because the skeptic at the table with the intuitive and mystic and empiricist and logician can help fuel the inquiry, the quest. When we bring our awakened awareness that says, what is life showing me now? Why on earth did this synchronicity land right in front of me on the bus so flagrantly of all days, of all times? After a failed in vitro lady, you look like just that type of lady that could go all around the world adopting children. Why that day? I never saw the gentleman again. No one else said it to me. It wasn't 2 years earlier or 2 years later once I had our family. This is the sense in which we are part of a unit of reality and we are built to be able to see into it. There is nothing rigorous about pulling the skeptic up from the table and making the skeptic the bouncer at the door. Tossing out possibility, foreclosing perception, limiting our lives is not rigorous. It is wasteful. Yes. The skeptic can sit at the table with everybody else and listen to what does my intuition say? What mystical experience mean? And perhaps throw an awakened discovery to achieving awareness. How will I now live this out to contribute in the world? Throw a profound experience to the discernment of logic. What does this mean for my path and how I should look into life more deeply? So a dialogue between intuition, a mystical opening, a synchronicity, and hey, what does that mean? I'll leave it open. I'll explore. But the discernment, the empiricism of, wow, wait a minute, why was it today? Did that really happen? That did happen. Listening to the validity of our direct experience. I find that the only greater casualty in our air and water of our culture to eviscerating the meaning in life is to eviscerate the legitimacy of our inner knowing. We're born with an inner compass and it is very good. It is very good. And not only do you need it for deep direction, you need it to help others along, your kids, your parents, your community, the life of the earth. We need these forms of knowing. We are sick as a culture and we're killing off our world because we're not listening to the voices around us, the voices of fellow living beings. If we use a deeper way of knowing, we will not have the same problems. We will not dump toxic garbage in a living river that's talking to us. We will not drop a bomb on other people who we know in our deep unit of awareness, our awakened heart knows to be our brothers and sisters. We simply won't do these things and we won't have the same problems when we use all of ourselves, when we take as valid our awakened brain.
I love this so much. And I love that metaphor of the table and which parts of our brain are ourselves. The knowers are invited to the table. My table, most of growing up, it's like the mystic and the intuitive, like, nope, you're not invited to the table, you know, and the empiricist and the logician, those are more kind of nurtured and encouraged and maybe valued, or they were higher up in the hierarchy. They were at the table.
Well, absolutely. That's the point, that our culture has confounded science with radical materialism. Our culture has confounded skepticism with dismissing forms of knowing other than logic and empiricism. And it has been to our extraordinary sickening. Yeah. We are killing our young adults. The rate of death by suicide rivals the rate of death by auto accident as the number one killer of young adults, because we've eviscerated the deep inner compass through which is found a meaningful direction, a deep connection to the unit of love and in through life. We've cut it out of them. And it's the worst thing we could have possibly done to our kids. When we validate, wait a minute, what did your gut say? Wait a minute. That dream came to you the night before you set out on your journey. Wait a minute. In your meditation, in your prayer, you felt a deep knowing. You received a transcendent guidance. That is valid. That is not only true, that is your greatest footing. There's no information as trustworthy as your relational transcendent awareness, your awakened brain.
So beautiful. I want to come back to this word you used about knocking at the door. And I'm thinking about these moments where we can awaken, where there's an opportunity, where our life or intuition or something comes knocking, right? That guy on the bus. And you mentioned the word choice. Like when the knock comes, we still have to make a choice to say yes. And what are those moments of knocking? And I'm brought to a chapter in your book, which is titled Two Sides of the Same Coin. And in my experience, and then you talk about this in the book as well, but it's oftentimes moments of challenge, and one moment of challenge in particular being depression. In those moments that are so of adversity, whether it's around our mental health, depression, et cetera, or other challenges in our life where we're sort of at the bottom. It's like sometimes, for me, those are the moments where life comes knocking. And then it seems in those moments that there can be a choice to open and to see, what does life have to say now? Or what direction makes sense now? Or whatever it is. Or to ignore or push away or whatever it might be. So could you talk a little bit about, and this is more of the how question. It's more of the cultivation question. How can we cultivate this capacity for awakened awareness? And these knocks on the door seem to be one of those opportunities to do just that.
Beautiful. To shift from what do I want, how am I going to get it, and why am I not getting it, to hey, what is life showing me now? What is source revealing to me now? What's being asked of me now? The knock at the door of a developmental depression is the ignition for the expansion of our awakened awareness. It is right there for us. But as you say, Joshua, we need to say yes and choose to take this quest. And it can be painful. It's not always easy, you know, and whether or not we use medication, I'm not anti-medication. Medication alone is insufficient to answer the call of a developmental depression. What in how I was being and living yesterday is now a cage that limits me for the person I am to emerge to be, to inherit the next mantle of life. How is yesterday's seat of being too small for the person that you are asked to grow into now to inherit the next station in your life? There's an inherent teleology in us. We are propelled towards spiritual growth, to be more loving, to be more present, to radical love, deep forgiveness, the capacity to be in deep dialogue with the deeper nature of life. How do we do that? Right? For some people, it's held in their faith tradition. It's held through prayer. It's held through insights found in nature. For some people, it's guided practices. I can share with you a practice that has been very helpful to thousands of people with whom I've worked, if you'd like.
Please, that'd be great.
Beautiful. This was a gift from the late Dr. Gary Weaver, who helped people reconnect with source, who helped people move from illusions of radical control and anger and loss to, hey, there's a dialogue with life. What is life showing me now? And how might I open to feel and see and know what is life showing me now? And how might I walk into that way of being? So this is a lovely opening. I invite you to close your eyes if you'd like and clear out your inner space with 5 breaths. I invite you in your inner chamber to set before you a table. This is your table. And to your table, you may invite anyone, living or deceased, who truly has your best interest in mind. And with them all sitting there, ask them if they love you. And now you may invite your higher self, the part of you that is so much more than anything you may have or not have, anything you've done or not done, your true, eternal, higher self, and ask you if you love you. And now finally, you may invite your higher power, however you know, whatever word is yours, your higher power, and ask if they love you. And now with all of those people sitting there right now, what do they need to share? What do they need to tell you now? What do you need to know? When you're ready, I invite you back.
Oh, thank you.
Did it resonate for you?
You know, for me, the way that that exercise was shared, I mean, your presence, first of all, as a teacher, I know you're a scientist and you've done the hardcore research, you lecture, you're, you know, a professor and all these things, but that was, I don't know, almost like a meditation teacher or something like that. And it was just very, it was beautiful the way you led it. So there was that piece of it that it was, you talked about this feeling of being held. Right. You mentioned those words and being loved. And so that type of presence from you was there in that. And then there was also for me, the answer was so obvious. It was just so readily apparent. It's like, of course you're loved, you know, like it was just, there wasn't doubt. The doubt was gone. And that was really powerful in a way that a lot of different practices I've engaged with, et cetera, just haven't had that type of effect. So yeah, thank you for that. It actually brings up something I wanted to talk to you about.
That the answer came, of course you're loved. I'll share with you my experience of engaging in a deep conversation, a deep dialogue, is that you have profound love in your heart, in and through you. Profound love as a spouse, as a father, as a teacher, through your podcast, as a host, engaging in deep ways with your guests. You hold a profound love, and it makes you, from out here, what might be called fearless.
Well, thank you for that. You don't know this, but I wake up in the morning and I think to myself, my intention for the day or goal for the day essentially is to just put love out into the world. That's the work, you know, for me. And at the end of the day, if I've done that, it's good work and it's done for the right reasons. And so that's every day. So thank you. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate that. So I want to share like a minute of context, because this is something I've been exploring, which is how do we create bridges across the incredible, sometimes incredible, not as incredible, division that's happening right now, polarization, et cetera. Big question. Don't expect us to have the answer right here, right now. But I think there's something from this particular practice that may be part of the answer to that. And so I'll share two past guests super briefly. One is a humility researcher named Dr. Daryl Van Tongeren. And I was really struck by his definition of humility, because he talks about it being founded in a real genuine sense of self-worth. If I feel that I'm worthy in my core, I'm okay with being wrong or not being so great at things or whatever it is. So this humility kind of arises from this foundation of self-worth. So that's point one. Then I have this second conversation with the director of research at the Constructive Dialogue Institute. And we're talking about, she's focusing a lot on politics and how do you have these conversations and how do you actually make them constructive? And I share this with her, right? This idea of not being so attached to our political identity or an idea, maybe being grounded in humility that's founded on self-worth. So maybe the self-worth is a big part of this, being able to actually have constructive dialogue. And what I found in this exercise coming back to this foundation of self-worth, is it this type of thing, whether it's in the moment or as a practice over time, I think it could lead to a greater sense of self-love and self-worth. There's so many outside structural things in our society, messages we're being told about ways in which we don't matter, who matters, who doesn't. Like, that's a big issue. And I was wondering, how can we get at this, building this, cultivating this foundation of self-worth? Big question. I don't pretend to have the answers by any means, but I think it's a question worth asking. And this practice you shared seems like maybe one way to build some of that foundation. And I'm curious about just your thoughts on that. And then if you think that there's anything to that of bridging divides built upon this foundation of self-worth that can be cultivated through some of the practices that you do.
May I share a little story?
Oh, please. Yeah.
So the other day I was at the Whole Foods. Everyone is healthy, or at least they dress and shop healthy, right?
They come
in their yoga gear and they come, their carts are full of kale and, you know, coconut yogurt, and everyone's healthy. But somehow, as I was standing in line at the checkout counter, there was one woman ahead of me, and my deep inner wisdom, my intuition, I could feel the receptive relational transcendent awareness saying, say it. Right? This dialogue with life, the dialogue with the universe, say it, say it. So I turned to her out of the blue, never met her. And I said, listen, you look really healthy. And she dropped her cart, started to cry. And she said, I'm starting chemotherapy tomorrow. She said, I do not feel healthy. They just took cancer from me. They operated on me. And I said, they took out cancer from you. You are healthy. So there were hundreds of people, and source, right? The dialogue with life said, say it, tell her she's healthy. So we're agents, like rays from the sun. We are all agents of source. We are agents of this deep unit of love that's in us and through us and around us. And so knowing who we really are, every single one of us, the woman with the cart and the day I delivered the message and every single other person in that store and every other store around the whole world, are agents of source. And that is the ultimate sense of mattering. We matter to each other. We matter to the fulfillment of the deeper nature of life. We matter. We matter tremendously. That has nothing to do, you know, I have absolutely no idea if the woman was a Democrat or Republican, but her ideas were about public policy. It was soul to soul, or ray of sun to ray of sun. So when I think of sacred consciousness or spirit, I think that we're emanations like rays of the sun, and yet in dialogue, doing our part, showing up, walking the walk as agents on behalf of source. That's the ultimate sense that every one of us matters. And there's so many incredible opportunities to fulfill our ambassadorship.
I love that so much. I'll just share this as a quick kind of final piece on this. In that conversation with the director of research at Constructive Dialogue Institute, her name's Mylene Duong, Dr. Mylene Duong. She's amazing. But I said, you know, kind of this similar piece. I've been watching more kids programming, you know, as my daughter, and we're watching programming together. And I've been a fan for a long time of Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers.
Oh, he's and beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, just, you know, and he used to have this song, I think he would sing, or what he would say, I like you the way you are. I like you just the way you are. That's it. I love what you said. Just the opportunities to let people know, hey, you matter, you know, like you matter. And that's an opportunity for all of us.
In and of itself, you know, this chronic world of measurement that goes hand in hand, Ben Zander talks about this as well, this chronic world of measurement, where I remember in high school, every single student in the class had their name listed top to bottom with a grade by it. Nowadays, that's not done. But, you know, I took music and I, you know, used to love to play the piano, and I would tear as I played sad ballads, and I felt so strong and I'd express myself. And then I went into advanced classes and it became about competitions and being given technical grades. So I remember going off to a competition, coming back, and my teacher, who used to be very, very frustrated that I did not practice enough, said, Lisa, of all my students, you were the one who did the best. And I am very surprised because you were the least prepared. And the reason I'd done the best is because in this world of measurement, at, you know, 12 years old, I'd gone in and I'd learned how to con the judge. I was super polite. I was very sweet. And I got the highest mark. And it absolutely eviscerated the inherent phenomenological joy of music. Mm-hmm. Become a transaction. And in a public square, in the air and water of our culture, minus an awakened heart, an awakened attention, an awakened mind, we it's become about owning and having and controlling and measuring. Well, the shift is, you know, what is life showing me now? What is the music saying to me now? How does the music make me feel? Where is the music as something that might be even ontologically like real, like its inherent stuff is an existence of sanctity taking me now and training my being? That is the high pixel reality, what might be said in between the measurement units. It is the stuff, it is the infinite space inside each instant of life. And that is an awakened life.
That's so beautiful. Lisa, we just have just a few, very few minutes left. I am just so grateful and filled with respect for the work you've done. It's been, and your writing and your openness and your vulnerability, just everything about your teachings has so deeply resonated with me. Thank you. And I'm sure thousands of people, as you mentioned out there, you're spreading love as well and doing it in a really, really wonderful and profound way.
Joshua, thank you for this very, very meaningful conversation. You're a wonderful thought and heart partner, and my very best to your whole family.
Thank you so much. Is there anything, just as we close in the last minute or two, that you haven't offered today? Someone's out there and they're listening and they're wanting to live a more awakened or courageous life that you'd offer as just a closing kind of invitation or thought on the conversation.
When you feel so much despair that you're free falling backwards, you will be caught. You're buoyant. When you don't know where to go, your trail angel will show up and synchronistically you are guided. And when you feel completely alone, every living being on earth is here in deep relationship. You are loved, held, guided, and you are never alone.
Thank you, Lisa. If people want to find out more about your work, the book, what's the best place or best places for them to do that?
So I share meaningful conversations like this, things I really care about, on Instagram. So it's ampersanddr.lisamiller, dr.lisamiller. And I'm very happy to connect with people through Instagram.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Courageous Life. I'd like to extend special thanks, as always, to my executive producer, Matt Donner, for all of the incredible behind-the-scenes work he does to make this show sound great. He's also responsible for composing the original music that you hear at the beginning and the end of every episode. Also, if you're enjoying the show and the conversation, please do share with friends, because I believe that courage is contagious. And while you're at it, if you happen to be on iTunes, make sure you click the subscribe button, or if you feel so compelled, leave a positive review. It encourages me to keep going and also helps others to find a valuable show amidst the many podcasts that are out there. Until next time, this is Joshua Steinfeld with The Courageous Life.